Good morning. I'm
Good
Brady.
Morning. I'm Brady.
And I'm Daniel.
And I'm Zach. Daniel.
And I'm Zach.
Water on the dipstick.
Okay, guys. So what we do at this point is we pause so that Daniel can cut this out for editing, and then he's going to add the little car revving thing.
Should I not just stop it?
If you've made it this far, you've had the misfortune of hearing one of our many intros. As we try to pan these out, please let us know your thoughts and leave a comment. Tell us how much you hate our voices, or how terrible our monologues are. Oddly enough, for Water on the Dipstick, we have two great guests, and we're excited to share them with you. And here they are.
And I sell car insurance. Would you like to buy some car insurance?
That's rough, because I sell car insurance. So.
I sell car insurance. Are you kidding? Oh, brother. Like, we are of the same. There's no shame in it.
Of the same.
Journalism is collapsing, and I sell car insurance, and there's no shame in that. And we are not on tape, but we're probably on tape, aren't we? Fuck. Anyway, you wanted intros. Okay. My name is Sam Smith. I am 41 years old. I have a bald spot. I grew up around cars in a restoration shop. I've been working in car magazines since probably 2006 full-time. Freelance on and off for about 4 or 5 years before that. Did a bunch of time at pretty much every magazine you can think of except Motor Trend, Car and Driver, Automobile. Spent about 8 years at Road and Track. Did a TV show for NBC Sports. Did another TV show for NBC Sports. And now, as we were talking earlier, I sell insurance for Hagerty. I think their company probably has a full name, but I don't know what it is. I write, I'm a journalist and YouTube guy and broadcaster for Hagerty, for the media division of Hagerty. And this is my friend Michael.
Hey, I'm Michael Chaffee. I am a technology consultant who used to be into cars, who happens to be visiting Sam and his family this weekend.
Used to be into cars?
Oh, we'll get into that. There's stories.
Okay, good.
Yeah, let's say. We relate. Yeah. We definitely relate.
Sam and I have been doing motorcycle stuff. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I spotted Terlingua and I got very excited. He's wearing
it's like a deep track, right?
Yeah, we're car nuts. You're gonna notice things throughout the day and be like, oh,
it's
good.
Yeah. It's all good.
And anybody wearing the chili Mustang Shelby Texas thing
is
all right.
They sell these at the ranch too. If you've ever been out to the spot where he used to hang out,
no.
And
this guy right here,
off,
Mustang
bad,
man,
Mustang
man.
I said we're cutting you off, man. So I'm sorry. Get back into it. Yeah.
No, I mean, I was just about done telling the story. The only thing left to say is like, Sam and I have been doing weird stuff with cars and motorcycles for going on 20 years now.
My chair creaks, I'm sorry.
It's all good.
Yeah, I rope chaff into a handful of stories because, like I said, we usually need... the great thing about journalism is that even 30 years ago when everybody had budget, there is never any money. You don't get paid any money. You don't have any money to do stuff. So, like, I think the last one was Alaska, right?
Yes.
We went to the Arctic Circle in a Jeep Wrangler press car with no doors in the middle of summer, and it started off kind of warm in Fairbanks, but it got to be 25 degrees on the tundra up near the
I want to be sure everybody understands that we made the intentional decision to remove the doors before we start talking about how cold it was.
But we understand the dealership too, right?
Yeah. Yep. Now, so
and they were fine with that?
So it was really interesting because I walked into the dealer and the guy I walked into the dealer and the guy was like, "Now, why you want to come back for these?" And I was like, "Yeah, please." And then he fed me some coffee that was like some of the best, worst coffee I've ever had, and started talking to me about how, like, when you get out in the middle of nowhere, there will be giant hills, and then you'll be standing there looking at the hills, and then you'll see like a herd of caribou or whatever coming over the hills, and that's when you go the other direction because they don't just run for nothing. There's usually a bear behind it. And then he gave me the whole spiel about how, like, if there is a bear coming at you, you go the other way. And I was like, "Well, that seems kind of obvious." And he was like, "Well, not to everybody."
Yeah. he made a real "I've got stories" face at that point in the narrative.
And then we left the doors and drove 400 miles north to the Arctic Ocean.
It was so cold.
It was
so cold.
The thing about a Wrangler, though, coming from a Wrangler guy,
yeah.
I had a TJ.
Previous Wrangler guy. He has moved on.
Oh, but he earned his stripes. He got rained on. He wouldn't put the top on.
He's been domesticated at this point.
Starting in March until about late October, no top, no doors. I mean, I was in college. It didn't matter.
Totally.
So, yeah. But the funny thing is, my mother's a rule follower by nature, and she really didn't appreciate the idea when I first got it of me taking the doors off. I was living at home. And I showed her, I took her out and showed her, because on TJ's, when you flip down the visor, it had a disclaimer that doors were not structural and were not even rated to keep you in the car.
Right.
Did that make her feel better?
Did you show her crash ratings afterwards? That's the selling
They're
point.
Negative.
Yeah.
And so the funny thing about doing that is, I mean, obviously the cold is one thing, but as far as a polar bear, as strong as they are, doors on, doors off makes no difference in a Jeep.
Oh, yeah, totally.
They're
going
to get in if they want to.
There was this great moment. So you get, so the further north you get, the tree line drops, right? Like the point where the trees can't grow any higher. And eventually you just get past the point where trees stop growing. And once you get past that point, you see these weird things like, you know, mountains that are massively tall but don't have a lick of green on them. It's just rock. And they start, there is no green from, you know, your feet all the way up to, you know, 1,000 feet.
Wow.
But once you get past that, you're on tundra, which is all just kind of weird, spongy, you know, growthity thing where the water table's super high.
It's weirder than you expect.
Oh, it's super weird. And that goes on for, like, you know, once you get up into it from like the top of Alaska to like the top of Alaska where, you know, the mountains are to the ocean is probably what, another 100 miles?
Yeah.
And you're just cruising and you can't, it's like driving across Kansas. You can't see anything. You know, when we went up there where there was fog over everything and the tundra's like super fragile. So if you put any weight on it, you know, your foot sinks up to your ankle and you're not supposed to step on it because it's ecologically protected.
What about the mosquitoes? Because you even made a big bit about that. And I want to hear you and Michael on that.
Oh, man.
They were...
Oh, man. Oh, man. Go. Not me.
All I remember is we went through a lot of bug spray.
That had DEET in it, right?
Yeah.
Because the guy at the Jeep dealer was real specific. He was like, do not get this. Do not get this. Do not. This is for little girls. Buy this.
Get the bug spray with the warning label on it.
Right.
This is
the one that basically like down 747s when you spray it in the sky. But so the point is, we got up there. You mentioned bears, right? We got up there and got onto the tundra, and we're just cruising along, and we're going for like 100 miles at, you know, maybe 70 miles an hour on this gravel road. And I look over. It was so cold. It was a moment where, like, at that point, because it's also, sorry, I told you I can't shut up. It's also because the sun doesn't set. You know, it'll be midnight, and it'll be still, like, you know, 4 in the afternoon light.
What? Yeah. Oh God. No. You just reminded me of the part where the golden hour went on for 4 hours.
Yeah. So the, you know, the time of day, like when the sun's about to set and everything looks great up there, because it's so far north that, you know, down here like Tennessee, even in Seattle, like that's maybe, you know, really far north. That's maybe like 40 minutes. You get a perfect light. Photographers love it.
Right.
Because all they have to do is point a camera at something. It turns out amazing. Up there, it's like 6 or 7 hours. Because, you know, you're on the peak of the planet, and
it's
everything's
just...
It's all golden hour. So our photographer,
he couldn't stop.
He's this short, chain-smoky guy out of Brooklyn who, like, is real grumpy. And I've never seen him that ungrumpy. But he was just like, I got to take a picture.
He was trying so hard not to look giddy. It was really cute. But, like, also, too, then we're going, Dave, it's 11:30 at night. Can we get some dinner? You know, and he's like, no, the light's perfect.
It's been perfect for hours. So we get up there, and everybody's all, you know, just, we didn't know what time it was. Everybody's all super tired. We're driving along. Like, at one point, we listened to Carly Rae Jepsen for, like, 20 minutes with the doors off, and it's every, I have not been that cold in forever.
This man saying "Call me maybe" out the door of a Jeep at a grizzly bear. Just for the record, we're
cruising along, and I'm driving, and I look over, and the tundra's just covered in fog on each side. You have maybe like what, 50 yards of visibility?
By 100 maybe.
Yeah, and out of the fog just comes this like galumphing, leaping, just brown shape, and it gets closer and closer, and it starts running alongside the Jeep, and we slow down. We're doing like 20.
Was it running? No.
Yes, it was.
Wait, really?
Yes, I slowed down because I wanted to pace it and see how fast it was going.
Oh, but it wasn't like alongside the Jeep.
It was
like a safe distance.
It was like 75 yards away.
Okay, I just want to make sure nobody thinks that it was in the next lane.
It was in my lap.
We're drag racing this thing.
But we see the bear, and we were also out of it. I yelled at it. Dave got mad at me for yelling at it, but you didn't get mad at me for yelling at it.
I was far too cold. Okay, so
bring him over.
Understand, this is 2 days north, 2 days south. A Jeep with no doors is colder than a motorcycle, which I did not expect. Also, we didn't rotate who was sitting in back with no heater vents and no heated seats. Nice. Which I also, you know, I was kind of like, we'll get a rotation going. This is going to be great. And then...
There's this moment where everybody stopped and put on all, like, you put on literally all of your clothes, and it wasn't enough.
Yeah, no, I looked like the kid in Christmas Story.
Because it was in the 20s, and then there was 60 or 70 miles an hour wind chill coming in the truck because it was doing 70 miles an hour.
And there's nothing to break the wind; it just comes blasting in from the sides. Oh, you know,
and it's worse in the back of the Jeep than in front of the Jeep.
How do you know?
Because I sat there for like 12 minutes and then weenied out and went back up front.
12 whole minutes. Mm-hmm. Still counts.
Can confirm, yeah. Yeah, no, when we got to Dead Horse at the northern, you know, so like the northern end of that road is just a whole big oil operation, right? And literally the first thing we did is we stopped at the general store in Dead Horse, and I literally picked up an entire like Carhartt, like you wear this if you're a roughneck in the Arctic, like suit, right? I was still cold.
So the there's some cold. Background on this. So the road we were on is the, what the name of the highway?
The Dalton?
The Dalton. Dalton Highway. It is one of the, it's like one of the roads they film Ice Road Truckers on.
Oh,
and
yeah,
like
yeah,
it
yeah.
is super, I talked to some people who've been up there before we planted. Like planning it took, you know, a couple months. And it is super, super dangerous in spring, fall, and winter. And in summer, you're just going to be really, really cold. But
that's when you all went too.
Yeah,
right?
we went in summer, but it goes basically from Fairbanks, and it is little bits of pavement for maybe like 50 miles, and then it turns into rutted, nasty gravel that's been sprayed with like chloride and
the thing that was crazy. Yeah, it was something like, I mean, it was basically just like chip seal, you know.
But it was sprayed over gravel, and it
came
up.
Wild.
But it turned into a paste. It got in our jackets.
Yeah, no, it was bonkers. Like, yeah, like I still find
so the
you
DEET
know,
felt
that
good
was,
after that. You're like, yeah, that's fine, whatever.
I keep it in my pocket. Then it was a little warm. Yeah, no. Do you remember the craziest thing is it's like you drive out of Fairbanks and you're on like a perfectly good like paved road for like 50 or 70 miles, and then suddenly you get to this point 50 or 70 miles out of Fairbanks, nothing around, absolutely nothing around, but there's like 18 signs being like proceed at your own risk, pavement ends, peril ahead, you know, and you would think this would be like at the outskirts of a town, but like, you know, the only difference between looking up the road and looking down the road is one side's gravel and the other side is pavement. And for some reason, that's where they made the change with the whole, like, production.
And it goes on for, I mean, it's there's a town at, like, 200 miles in that's basically just a bunch of trailers that was used by the construction crew that built the road 60 years before.
That's
a bunch of trailers and a cardboard hotel.
There was a cardboard hotel. It was really, it was crazy too, because like there are little things that you notice. Like we stopped there the first day, because you do about 200 miles a day for sanity, basically. We stopped there the first day, and we stayed in the cardboard hotel, which, you know, was made of cardboard. And I looked outside the window of my room, which was not much bigger than this table. And one of they had internet there. They had Wi-Fi.
But it was wild.
It was like $20 and super slow, but it was satellite, and there was a satellite, because you were so far north, there was a satellite on the roof that was pointed horizontally.
Yeah,
it was down to the the geostationary stuff that's down on the rest of the continent further south. So you see it literally doing this, pointed at the equator, because the equator was basically to the right.
That's amazing.
Super weird. But
was there a motorcyclist on this trip as well?
Heck yeah.
Because you even made the motorcycle comparison. It was warmer on the motorcycle than in the Jeep.
Because you're straddling the motor? Is that the difference?
Well, I think it's because, like, on a bike, like, you've got a motorcycle in front of you that kind of breaks the wind, and you're in a little bit of a bubble, even if you don't have, like, a big fairing or whatever.
Yeah. Back of the Jeep, and you're just getting funnel hit.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. It just blows through like this. God. Nobody saw. Everything's fine.
We're all good.
It's amateur hour for us. You see what we're working with?
I can't. Oh, dude, don't worry about it. I can't. You want to talk about amateur hour? I'm sitting here doing this in your poor chair, just making everybody listen to me move back and forth.
It's grateful.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's fine. People will listen to it just for...
It makes it authentic.
That's great.
But yeah, it's...
Sit on down now.
I don't know.
Stop.
I'm sorry for you.
Everyone is.
But yeah, it was just this weird... Weird long experience. And you know, it's 400 miles of road, and there's nothing. Like, there's a gas station at maybe every 70 or 80 miles. And when you are in the middle of nothing, you sit there and you look around, and there's just this deep realization that there are still parts of the planet that we have not put anything on.
Yeah.
Did you stop at every one for like redundancy's sake? So yeah. Even if you've only gone 70, like I'm filling it all the way up.
Yeah. We had a jerry can or three. I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We had to use them too. Yeah. So it had to have been more than 70 or 80 between stations.
I don't know if we would have needed to use them if we hadn't stopped for photos. Like, there's so much screwing around for photos.
How do diesel trucks make that kind of haul though? Like, I get that they have a lot more capacity, but do
they must just be able to do it, because there's only two. There's only one. I think there's because after the river, there was that one stop after the river that had the weird food.
Okay, the stop after the river with the weird food had gas, right? Yeah. It was just that. It was weird food.
You'll have that.
Ladies and gentlemen,
but that was it. That was like basically Fairbanks, the cardboard hotel town, the weird diner by the weird bridge town. And then Dead Horse, where, for the record, in 2018, gas was $7.50 a gallon, if I remember right.
Oh, so it's you get
literally
up there,
right next to the oil wells too. Like, come on, it's right there.
And that's this whole thing, right?
So it's because you have to ship it down and then back up. Right?
Oh,
you have to
ship it down. That's right.
Because it's not refined. So the trucks are just there solely to get stuff to and from the refinery, and the oil wells. The oil wells are all at the end of the road because that's where the fields are, and they're on the tundra. They're all like lifted up on stilts and in these weird kind of Mars looking buildings. So the wells themselves are jacketed.
Wild.
They're in indoor oil wells because it gets too cold.
Wow.
So you see these giant buildings that look like an oil well, except dumber. And then you stare at them for a second, you realize the well is inside it.
Wow.
But all the stuff that they brought in for everybody to live in, because like guys go up there and do like 3 or 5 month stints working the wells.
Good night.
Everybody stays in these. I mean, it looks like science fiction moon camp. I mean, it's so weird.
Well, that was the craziest thing when we were there, right? Is like both Dave and Zach, the motorcycle guy, each of them independently remarked that this is probably what the first moon base is going to look like.
Yeah.
I mean, the entire place, it looked like those French artists that wrapped everything in the world in like plastic. That's what the whole town looked like, because everything was just inside like some kind of plastic, like hoop house, geodesic structure. It was crazy.
Yeah, and it's not. There's an airfield there. Apparently, for the first so the stuff comes in on trucks, but anything the trucks, what is it? It's so it's actually there's so much stuff that it is actually cheaper to bring in by airplane. So the semis usually only bring in fluids in bulk, right? Or take fluids. It's for oil up and oil back.
Mm. And equipment.
And equipment stuff, right? And but like heating oil and waste and stuff all goes out by airplane. So it's insanely expensive.
And you said there were old planes out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In the article. What era?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that my dad, he was in the military for about 25 years. And he spent time up in Alaska. And he talks about how you get to a certain place and them having a bush plane is the way we have a car.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I can't even get my head around that. Yeah. I mean, because we have recreational flying. We're right by an airport. But,
I mean,
that's just what everybody has. Like, that's how they have to. They really wouldn't function without that.
There are towns. You get up there and you start looking at the map, and like the big cities that everybody's heard of, like Anchorage and Fairbanks, are on a road. But then you look at the map and you open the map and it's like, okay, the cities are connected by roads, but there are all these other dots that don't have anything going to them. Some of them have, you know, unmarked or lightly marked, you know, unpaved roads going to them, but a lot of stuff just doesn't. There's stuff up in the Aleutians and on the coast that the only way anything, literally anything, people, fuel, food, anything comes in and out is airplane.
Yeah.
And, you know, you land at the Fairbanks airport and there is the runway, and then there is a water runway next to it that is full of stuff on floats. And like all the, so you asked about the cargo stuff. There is, what's the name of the airline? This is C-46.
Oh.
Like famously they do.
Everts Air Fuel.
Yeah. So there's one airline that does a lot of cargo bush flying that uses, what's a C-46? Globemaster? No, what is
Commando.
It? Commander. They use the C-46, of which there are like three left flying in the world, and they
something
have two
like
of
that.
Them or something like that.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing else. And this is like, I mean, it's a Curtis double engine, triple engine, quad, two, radio. God, I'm bad at words. this massive thing that has not been contemporary since the 40s, that there is nothing else that has that much lift that much cargo capacity? Is that efficient on fuel? And it's just the only answer for getting stuff in and out. So they have the only two airplanes left doing active cargo work in the world.
Two out of the three flying. And then everything else they have is like old like DC-3s, DC-4s.
Yeah. Because it just works. It
they
is,
work.
You don't, and they can repair it without, you know, buying plastic things.
Are y'all familiar with the Mustard, the YouTube channel?
Yes.
Which one?
Mustard.
No.
Oh, great.
What
I
is this?
To show you this
great.
Evening.
It is so great.
Something to do
really?
After.
Excellent channel.
If you're a plane train guy, it's great.
So okay. Mustard awesome. Just got a plug.
Shout out to Mustard.
He earned it.
So something that amazes me, because he goes through a lot of historical airframes that aren't still around.
Yeah.
And so often, we don't follow these things to their end where we can conclude it won't work. It's just that the economics fall out.
Yeah.
That's the crazy thing about planes, because so even the airbase that we're right next to, the airframes, we have one that's a 61. You can look at the tails. The KC-135Rs that they're flying, they were retrofitted about 25 years ago that make them Rs, but it's a 70-year-old airframe.
Yeah.
That, you know, and you're talking about the wealthiest military power by a long shot.
Right.
It's just a different, they don't mature the way cars do. There's just and because there's so much expense to bringing something new, that you wind up that you stick with these things for a long time, and that's just it doesn't surprise me to hear. In one way that's amazing to hear, but on the other hand it's not surprising at all, because there's this weird things that persist in aircraft.
Why reinvent the plane if it's not broke? Don't fix it.
About 10 I guess it was about 10 or 12 years ago, before I came to R&T, I had a couple of years where I was freelancing, and I did a thing for Popular Mechanics on the U2 and went, you know, the spy plane, right? Dates of the Cold War. Great Scary Powers shut down in one, like this, you know, 70,000-foot airplane that has a film camera where the film in it is, you know, larger than a sheet of paper. And...
Goodness.
And is this massively, massively efficient thing with, you know, a wingspan that's twice the length of the fuselage, but they're still flying them. And it's not like, you know, it's a bit like the B-52 or the 135, where, you know, there is just no better answer, but also like the B-52, where there have been like four or five block updates, you know, where they go through the entire airframe. So you look at a modern U-2, it was crazy, because like the story that I did, we got to, it was actually on, because literally everything in my life revolves around cars. It was on the chase cars that they use for spotting during landings. Because the fun thing about the U-2 is that, there are two things at play. One, it has a bicycle gear setup. There is a double axle gear up front in the nose. There's one like in the middle of the fuselage, and that's all it has. And on takeoff, they have these little outriggers, these pogos, that go in the end of the wingtips, so the wingtips don't drag. But the moment any load goes off, and they drop away. Right, Brady. So they drop away. And on landing, when you come in, your whole job is to not drop the wingtips, right? So, but this is also an airplane that has a massively high stall speed for what it is, that has a very narrow control window, and the controls become much less effective at low speed. And to boot, like, everybody knows what a U-2 looks like or an SR-71 looks like. Right. You're in the cockpit, you have like 15 degrees of vision out the front of it, or 20 degrees of vision, and that's it. So all that stuff that's behind you, you just don't see. So they have chase cars, and where basically they put another U-2 pilot who was not in an airplane that day in, for a while it was, you know, for a long time they used Camaros. At one point they were using, I want to say it was big block GM wagons of some sort.
Oh, that's cool. Like, that's awesome.
They,
I think I heard at one point they were running Grand Nationals.
Oh, my God. Really?
Because
if you think about it, they need something that's big, that won't get tossed around by the weight coming off the jet. They need something that's got a lot of torque, because they wait at the end of the runway, and then when the thing comes over the runway, I don't know what the stall speed is on it, but it's highway speed or better.
80, 90.
Okay.
Wow.
And they need to be able to sit there, and the moment it comes over, gun it and catch it.
Yep.
And they end up they have to be really close, so they end up about, I don't know, probably, let's say, 15, 20 degrees off the axis of the jet, in its like hindquarter blind spot, as pilots are coming in. And they'll sit there and they'll go, you know, left wing tip up, right? There's language for it, but it's basically you're going down on the left, you're up on the left, nose high, nose low, things like that. And they talk them down to the ground. And so I got to ride in one of these cars while the U2 landed. Oh, man, dude. At some point, after this, I'll pull. I've got pictures on my phone of sitting in a car where there is a U2 like 10 feet in front of me, about 10 feet off the air. And you're sitting in the car, and they're just talking on the radio, and they're all nonchalant about it. And the whole thing smells like it's not Jet A. What's it, is it JP? What do they use?
I mean, it's Jet A. It's JP something because it's the military, but it's just Jet A in a different.
So the whole car reeks of kerosene. Like you can barely breathe, and you're sitting there, and it's
sounds
you
like
are
a Mustang. We've
hey,
you're staring down, basically staring down the Tudor of like one of the most impressive machines we've ever made, as like some dude in the cockpit is having a really hard time putting it on the ground, and even the good ones need the chase plane. And it's interesting too. So the air freight, the air airbase they do it out of is near Sacramento. It's where the SR-71 was based, because they are high enough and fast enough that they can be based there. The guy was telling me, he was like, "Yeah, we'd go up to Seattle for lunch." And I'm like, "Well, how long did that take?" And he said some number that made me went, "What?
Wait, you took an SR-71?"
No, an SR-71. But so like the U-2, they will literally, you know, they'll wake up and overfly the West Coast and then come back. But they do all the training there too. And so they'll go up, and the really cool thing about this program is that that airplane has just been pushed and pushed and pushed to be relevant, because, you know, you think, okay, well, their whole job is flying over things and taking pictures. Can't we use satellites for it? And I had a guy explain to me that A, satellite time is very expensive. The U-2 is a relatively cheap airplane to fly. B, the resolution they get out of the film camera is still better than what a satellite can pull,
wow,
which is insane. And C, like booking satellite time, A, you have to book it, and B, you have to like, you have to make sure that like there has to be a satellite in orbit over what you want to see and at the right point in his orbit. And sometimes it's easier to just, you know, send it, launch a U-2, and then go look down at it and then get the thing back on the ground and develop film. And like they've now at the point where I want to say there's something like a scanner in the airplane. They could beam stuff down. They converted it to, it's still film, but there is some digital element to
it. Beam it down, Scotty.
Maybe it's like a CCD under it, or
I feel like they added a digital imager but kept the film camera, I think.
That makes sense. So we ended up sitting there, and they train all the guys to do it there. And when you are, I promise I will shut up about airplanes in a moment. Sorry.
It's hey, it's everything on this show. You're good. Yeah.
When you are, the crazy thing is like, in order to fly a U-2, you have to. It's like trying out for the Blue Angels, right? You apply for it. You are selected. You know, if you have a certain amount of experience, then you get to like the Blue Angels. They basically just, you know, it's a premium thing. You do a tour, but with the U-2, it's like the SR-71 was, where they bring people in, and if you meet certain criteria, if you have such and such a record, they'll put you in the airplane, and you have like some set amount of time to go through the school and learn it. And at the end of it, when you've done all the ground school and had like the in-flight trainings, you get so many number of landings that you can nail, and if you can't nail them, you wash out. And the number is something crazy. It's like 3 or something. So you have these guys, and I was like, well, how often did that happen? He's like, often enough that, you know, we've decided it's pretty hard. Like, the fact that guys will spend, like, some of the best pilots in the Air Force will, you know, go up in this airplane, learn to fly it, like, put on, because they wear basically, the suits they wear, pressure suits they wear, basically, it's like,
it's
you see pictures,
Gemini
you see pictures of guys in SR-71s, it's the orange thing, with the slide-down helmet, it is hard 1960s stuff. And they'll put them in all that, and they'll go up, and they'll, you know, see the curvature of the Earth, and fly the airplane, and come back. And, you know, they come down, and he said, it's really, really common for guys to just, people to just wash out because they can't put the airplane on the ground. And, you know, they've burned up. There were 2 or 3 two-place trainer U-2s that were built out of crashed airframes, and then somebody crashed one of them, but they were always crashed. All the crashes come on landing, and there are more crashes in training than there are in active flight because of the way the training works. It's crazy. Wow. Anyway, no more airplanes.
I think at this point, one more thing on airplanes. Just really, I just want to tie a bow on this really quickly, and that's to say that there's currently 3 incredibly old airplanes that the U.S. Air Force absolutely depends on, right? The B-52, the U-2, and the C-130. And I'd just like to point out that 2 of those 3 planes were designed by one Kelly Johnson. Shout out to a real one.
Lucky. Yeah. Anyway.
So we've been thinking about questions, and I have one that I will just hate it if I don't get to ask it while I've got the opportunity. It's not the one you think.
Well, that's good.
The one I thought was not good.
I hope
so,
that one.
Don't need to drink more for that one.
It's so dumb. Okay.
I like dumb questions.
I'm just saying.
Spread me with a good time.
Twist my arm, why don't you?
One of my favorite, like, growing up, I was a weird kid. I read Reader's Digest as a kid. But one of my favorite things was...
Digest part, mostly.
Right.
I like the jokes, you know, where it's like some tame senior citizen goes...
Yeah, right. Anyway. It's almost funny because it's not funny.
Right.
So one of my favorite sections in it is what your, you know, blank won't tell you. You know? I want to know. There's the adage, you know, don't meet your heroes. And one thing I love about getting around industries and what you learn on the inside that just people outside don't know... From being around it,
there's
so little room in my perspective. Like he said, so much of it's in California, and some of it's just unattainable. I feel like Freiberger and Finnegan have done done a good job with that brand of getting to get access to them. But there's just so much stuff that's at these closed tracks. There's not a lot of reach to it, at least from my perspective. What's the hero you wish you hadn't met? Like what's the dirty secret of the industry that, like you know where the blinders fell off and you kind of cut your teeth learning what it's really like.
How to say that without insulting dead people, defaming dead people, or
they won't mind.
There's like three active listeners. You're looking at them. You're pretty good.
Hello, Mom. I take that back. She's dead. She can't listen.
Samuel.
Sorry. She would find that funny.
She absolutely would. It's true. It's true and fair.
But I don't know. You know, it's let's do the diplomatic version of that. There are some people who I thought were going to be very kind and thoughtful who ended up being arrogant pricks. Mm. There are a lot of people in the business who. So I am something of an exception, and this doesn't make me special, it's just like weird.
Forgive me.
My phone just went off. I'm something of an exception in that, like, I am a journalist who has done some club racing and have a little bit of experience and can slide cars and, you know, do stunt driving and things like that. And
I just want to just interrupt for just a hot second.
Yeah.
This man's an artist behind the wheel. He's being very modest right now. Go ahead.
His associate editor's
you, and now I'm really uncomfortable. No, but like I'm relatively capable and can do that stuff. And coming in, I thought that was just like bar for entry, right? That was what everybody had to do. And it turns out that there's a stereotype that car journalists can't drive and crash a lot. And it turns out that most of them can't drive and crash a lot.
Really?
Ouch.
And I am not, you know, I'm no Senna or Schumacher or Dale or pick your name, right? But, you know, I can drive a race car and not end up in a wall 99% of the... Shut up! He's making thumbs. Chaffee's making gestures. But that was shocking. It's also remarkable how many guys don't... And women. Don't really... You know, I came up reading an awful lot. And history really matters to me. And I care about it so much. Because it is relevant, right? You know, the whole idea that... A, you don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. But B, you don't know how stuff fits in context.
So
what anything matters, what weight it carries, unless you know where it was. You know, part of the reason that you can, like you drive modern McLarens, for example, and some of them have things that actually are in common in how they feel and how they're built and how they're thought about by the people who built them with, like, a McLaren F1, you know, 30-year-old car that was made by the same company when it was completely different. Or you look at how... You know, like the Mustang's a perfect example. You know, if you have like an S550 and an S197 are very different cars.
Oh, yeah, independent rear suspension just right off the bat.
Right,
yeah.
But they feel there are things that they have in common that they feel similar.
Yeah, and they haven't changed the DNA.
Yeah.
Like so many car manufacturers reinvent their image and it kills it for enthusiasts.
Right.
Just speaking from someone who grew up, like I grew up on Mustangs and all other stuff. Like we love Corvettes, we love McLarens, but.
Yeah.
If you get it wrong, the people that really care notice.
Right.
And if you don't know your history as a manufacturer, it matters.
Yeah.
It very much does. Even with nomenclature.
Yeah, you would name an electric car a Mustang.
And so
call it the Mach-E.
Right.
Just
so
don't put Mustang in it.
We're all sort of on the same page. It's a phenomenal electric vehicle,
yeah,
but
But that's the thing, right? Like, if you know, and you know, they're like a the Mustang discussion is interesting. Like, I had several years ago, I had a 65 Fastback. It was just nothing special. It was a
Fastback.
Yes, it was.
Sam's done it all.
It was special because it was a Fastback.
Hey, this man knows his numbers.
66. They hit a million by 66.
You're right.
They started
you're
at 64 and a half. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Corvette took 40 years to hit a million.
Oh, but there's a man with a
premium New Balance.
Slicing and dicing.
He's sitting next to the Corvette guy. ZX6 outside in the garage.
No, hey, I like Honda CRVs, okay?
I had a CRV.
Yeah. 300,000 miles, drives fantastic.
I just got one to see
every time I get in it. I love it.
We had a manual 05 that my wife drove that we bought at 120 and took to 170, I guess, and it ate an alternator. It ate rotors, and it ate...
That was such a good car.
Well, a bunch of vomit from my kids, but it didn't eat anything else. It was
Isn't
amazing.
Isn't that what CRVs do best, though? Eat vomit from kids? We're about to have a kid, and we have a CRV.
Congrats.
It's not
you
a
know,
car.
No, no, no. We're about to have it.
Okay, good point.
Yeah. Mazel tov.
Yeah, it was God, it was great because in the winter you couldn't smell it, and you knew when it was summer, you knew when it was no amount of cleaning, man. Oh, every hot geez. Day you'd just be like, "Yep, it's come back."
Spilled milk does that too.
Oh,
it's over. My mom had a Maxima.
Stop!
Never,
stop! That's episode one. Yeah. Don't go back to spilled milk. Done. You're cut off. Yeah, we're cutting you off.
But just to close the circle on the Mustang thing, like there are things that a 65 has in common with a Fox Body, has in common with. An SN95 has in common with a 197 or a 550, right? They're all very different cars, but you can see the line. And when what's really interesting is when car makers start making the choice to take stuff away. So like Corvettes, right? So the C8 is a deeply approachable, I haven't driven Z06 yet, but the base C8 is a deeply approachable, soft kind of, it's the only mid-engine car I've driven that feels like it steers and moves from the front of the car. It leans on the front tires hard.
That's so on brand.
It is, but that's the thing. You talk to them and you're like, I don't know, man, how... Because like we had... First time I drove one was Road & Track's performance car that you're testing at Thunder Hill in... Well, I don't remember when that would have been. But we had some of the engineers out and we had a couple pro drivers with us and the whole staff drove it and we all got out of it. We were like... What's going on? Because like the car is not real sharp on entry into the corner. Like it does things in the corner that mid-engine cars usually do sharper. It's a little softer.
I've heard that a lot. Throttle so, house, a lot of people have done
so,
that.
So the interesting thing is you get out of it and you're like, I don't know, man. It like it's a little pushy. It's not super sensitive to steering and throttle inputs. Like the car just kind of falls on the nose in the middle of the corner and then sets there. It's real stable, but it's not, it doesn't poke you. Like mid-engine cars, when you get them up on the limit, they typically are interesting and dicey and needle-thready, and they do exactly what you want the moment. You know, the cliche with a race car is race cars do exactly what you want when you want, even if that's the wrong thing.
Right.
Road cars will sometimes not let you do the wrong thing, right? But that... We talked to engineers about it. We're like, why'd you make those choices? Because the thing about cars is that, especially in engineering, especially in like handling, everything's a choice.
Right.
Like it all comes down to, you know, what cost what, you know, which component they wanted to spend for, and then some human at the end of it signed off on the handling balance. And they were like, well, here's the thing. We have an awful lot of people who are used to how, we have a lot of customers who are used to how front engine cars drive.
Yep.
And we wanted to make this forgiving and approachable because you hop into a Ferrari, you hop into a McLaren, and they are kind of dicey things, especially when you drive them hard, and we wanted to make this friendly. And I said, so is that how all of them are going to be? And he's like, can't talk about future product, shrug, shrug, shrug. And it turns out, like, from talking to the people I know who've tested the Z06, Z06 is not like that because it is a different market.
And the Zora will be the same, I assume?
Probably, yeah. And that's like that is them making choices to, you know, the people who want the car that behaves a certain way, they're going to buy a Z06 or the top shelf thing.
Yeah. That's
fair. And it's in a lot of ways you have to respect it, and people have liked it and the thing sells. So, you know, on the one hand you can poke at it and be like, you're raising your hand, hush. I'm monologuing.
Okay, as long as
he's monologuing. Give him a minute.
Don't change topics, I have a Corvette question.
Everything I have to say is amazing. I'm going to continue for 4 hours. No, it but yeah, it's crazy because like those are all things that they think about. And you know, like there's a certain insurance company that will not insure McLarens anymore because they just get crashed too much. And the thing about a McLaren is that, like, they have really good stability control systems. They're also real dicey, and you drive one real hard, you can put the car into a corner in a way the stability control will not save you. Like, I mean, stability control can do anything that brakes can and throttle chop can, right?
Independent braking and all.
Which means that if you fire a car into a 45-mile-an-hour corner at 80, it's not going to save you. And so, like, there are, you know, there are ups and downs to the way any of that stuff is dialed. And it's just interesting that it's all choices. And again, that doesn't make the C8 bad or good. It's just those were the choices they made. Right?
And they stuck to their market.
Yeah, they knew who they were talking to. And like, typically, you know, GM has had so... The Corvette, the big dirty secret about the Corvette is that, you know, every 5 minutes, somebody inside tries to cancel it. And, you know...
You mean like the Camaro?
Big oof.
Yes.
I hate that because I love the Z28 and the Z01
but that's,
and stuff.
That, part of that is GM, but part of that is just like low volume, high cost, low margin cars are real hard to justify. It's why the Viper died.
Unless you're Bentley. Right? Because they just had an out. I was reading, and I'm boring. I'm a banker. I read, you know, Market Watch and stuff like that.
Oh, you actually get paid. What's that like? Yeah. How does that work?
More money, more problems.
He says that you get lined up and slapped with a banana peel at the
end.
Is there money in it? I do it. That sounds great. Yeah. I bet you have health insurance. That's amazing.
Well, no. They have, and this kind of ties to that. So Bentley had just they had a fantastic year last year.
Yeah.
They doubled it this in 2022. Yeah. And they're doing the bespoke thing to the nth degree,
right?
They could reach a point where there's no two alike on the road because there's so much customization, and there's the economy of scale to support that because we have the largest wealth disparity like in the history of recording these things. But that aside, what's funny is I think about that sometimes with the U.S. We have this tendency. You can think of any interest, and we have the means, generally speaking, as you know, as participants in an economy, to far outpace our ability with what we can acquire.
Yeah.
Here's a silly example: golf clubs. Like, everybody wants pro golf clubs
not everybody.
But the problem is the forgiveness thing. That's common across a lot of different disciplines. So how much can an amateur get away with this? Because the race car thing is true of so many things. What makes a great golf club for you know, your golfer of choice is that it does what he wants it to do or she wants it to do. But if you don't know what you're doing, that's the problem. So that's just so funny that they recognize. It's like, you know.
They do and they don't, right? And Bentley's an odd case because their margins are a lot fatter than you think, but the company's a lot less like, they are, their financials are a lot more sketchy in ways that you wouldn't expect. Mm-hmm. But the product thing is interesting, right? Because, you know, there are... Take 129, right? Those two Mustangs out there, in the hands of somebody who really knows what they're doing, could run down anything on 129. And Mustangs are not supercars. But I guarantee you that, like, you know, a hot McLaren in the hands of somebody who's a 10 out of 10 driver and a hot Mustang on most back roads in a 10 out of 10 driver, you know, those two cars are going to hang, right? And a lot of it comes down to, you know, the fact that most road cars are just too much for modern roads. And manufacturers are, you know, for years they chase numbers to sell the stuff.
We've talked about this.
We have. And honestly, that doubles back to your Corvette comment. Like, if we're being real, most of the people that you sell cars to do not care about cornering G's or how much traction you get laterally. They just care about 0-60. Yeah. And you put something behind you, the engine, and you really set that weight back. Like, they're killing everything at red lights with minimal input.
And the funny thing is, too, like, they care about 0-60, but they care about it less than they ever have.
Right.
You know, we are. So I used to work with a guy named Jace Gamisa, who has a pretty heavy YouTube presence at the moment, and is very, very good at what he does. But at one point, we were both just staffers on the same magazine, and Jason has a big head for numbers and a big head for spreadsheets. And he started pulling things out at one point and realized that no amount of tire technology will get us further than physics and weight transfer will allow, right? You know, we are at the bottom limit of acceleration, meaning that a front-wheel drive car is limited by weight, where it carries it, and how it puts its power down. I mean, we have a 3-year-old GTI that cannot keep the tires glued in first, right? like with stability control on it, can't keep glued. You know, there are the bottom limit for 60 mile an hour times is basically, it was reached a couple of years ago, and you know, to the point where most of the hypercars will do it in just under, you know, somewhere between high ones and high two twos, seconds.
Yeah.
And at that, I mean, you know, that's, I forget what a Tesla Plaid is, but you know,
1.99.
That's in the same range.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, at that point, it's neat, but it's not fun. You do it a couple times, you get kind of sick.
I've heard people say their neck hurts and it's all kinds of things.
And it stops being useful, right?
Right, because you're just draining it. It has to set up. You do the cheetah mode. It starts to position itself and get its weights up. It's not just a you go. Yeah. It's still fast if you just go. But
we've talked about how there's how lifeless, and I mean this broadly, how quickly you get to monotony with electric platforms.
Yeah.
Right. So like GM's doing the thing where essentially they're going to have like one literal rolling platform, and they're just going to, you know.
Hey, but the Hummer can crab walk. Right, watch it now.
They're just going to drop different shapes on it, and that's what it's going to be. It's going to be this with different shapes on top.
Yeah.
But one thing that I hope that does, because I don't think, I don't know, but we go back and forth. We deliberate all the time about how much more time, you know, ICB engines have. But for hopefully they just get comfortable in their and with themselves, and we're past the horsepower wars, and we're just driving. Because I've never heard any article I've read, anything I've ever watched, I've never heard anyone call the Sesto Elemento their favorite car they've ever driven, or the, I mean, you know, just pick it. I'm picking on that one, but it's always some 50-year-old Mercedes or some 50-year-old Porsche that gets to 60 maybe next week. I mean, you know, and but that's not why, you know, they've driven all these cars like y'all have. You drive all these cars.
Cars are not rational buying experiences for anyone either. Right, like people that try to go to numbers, that just never works. You look like you need to say something, Michael.
I have a lot to say about this.
Okay,
it's
not good, the bus. Good. Here
right.
it is.
Strap in. I have my beer.
No, but seriously, I was kind of cracking wise earlier about like how I used to be into cars, but it's literally this, right? Like as soon as an Accord you buy at the dealer can get around a corner faster than it is safe or responsible or useful to go around a corner
it'll
in the real world.
Out-accelerate our Mustangs.
What does it matter how much better a Porsche can handle than that Accord? You know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of my whole challenge, right? And like as an engineer, I was gonna say as an engineer sooner or later. As an engineer,
there it is.
Okay. Ching, I got a couple.
Okay.
More.
Just time
wait.
To go, and I'm gonna be over there.
Oh wait till I get.
If he starts talking about computer science,
if I start talking about as a corporate technology
restroom.
Consultant, run. we have anyway. Like I think the beginning of the end for me is when I realized that, like, you know, the last 20, 30, 40 years, right? Engineer, like every part of engineering, especially things like computation and metallurgy and things like that, have gotten so good, and also like just communication and knowledge sharing has gotten better.
Yeah.
Anybody can go make a great car, right? Like you almost can't buy a car. you would have to like
unless
as a CVT,
unless FCA made it.
Well,
I'd take a Dodge Viper any day. I'd push it if I have to.
Both barrels, brain coming in blazing.
Brain doesn't pull punches.
sorry. Good.
No, you're good.
That Jeep life ruined
them. I'm just kind of thinking ahead. I'm like, you know, I've not yet driven a Hellcat. I would like to.
They won't warrant. I've heard they won't warranty them.
No, they won't.
I thought they will.
Yeah.
I thought they wouldn't warranty the.
You
engine.
Said that the other day, and I had to look it up because I was like, I don't know.
Huh.
Yeah. They'll still warrant them. I don't know.
I mean,
you
said FCA. What you probably really meant to say
Stellantis.
Is it not FCA anymore?
No, I was going to say Nissan or half of Ford or some of GM or all of BMW. We got lists, man. We got long lists.
Okay, so we did the last episode we did that's out is a premise where somebody
the challenge.
Yeah, the $200,000 challenge.
Oh
where
my gosh!
You get $200,000 between $200,000 and $300,000 to buy a car. And it, like it'll pay if you need to import it, import fees, taxes, whatever. The car comes to you. You have up to $300,000, but then for 5 years, it's your daily, and you have to cover all maintenance, repairs, etc.
And my commitment at least.
As soon as I said this, the words just got out of my mouth, and Zach goes, "So nothing German."
You said this, and I can hear the voice in Michael's head where it's like, I'm going to buy a house and a bicycle, and all y'all can go to
I mean, you explicitly
not a house
a
in this market, though, unfortunately.
Okay, super fair. The look on my face was just ideating. I'm like, what's my $200,000 car?
Well, so we'll go through ours real quick.
Yeah.
Mine was just dumb.
I got crucified for mine. Did I bring it back
you
up?
The idea was you had to use it every day. You had to use it at your job. You had to spend at least $200,000. That's what got me, because I'm so cheap. I was looking at rebuilt title cars and
at
stuff.
At least
and
two?
Brady just...
between, you have to spend between two.
Can you buy $200,000 cars?
No. One car for $200K.
The whole point is...
That's a difficult question.
Yeah, someone gave you the money. You have to spend at least $200,000, but less than three. And I found, because I'm just a Mustang nut, I found a 68 GT500, but it was a KR. And that's what brought the value up. And I was like, I can work on it. It's a 428 Cobra Jet. That's pretty easy. You can find parts for it. I've wrenched on stuff like that all my life.
Yeah.
It's great. It was a four-speed car.
His was the best answer. I went for absolute,
insanity and just went for the RS200.
You found one bringing a trailer,
too.
We had to find exactly.
It would be a challenging day, but it would be a fun daily.
Oh, yeah.
Until, you know, the first week was over and you were in misery for the next 5 years.
And
the principal problem is, what is your usage profile,
right?
Because, daily driver means something very different to somebody who's stop and go for an hour every day versus...
He gets on the highway and goes
It's interstate
for,
driving, so it wouldn't be stop and go necessarily.
We joked he'd drive medians to make
it I probably would. Yeah, you cross back and forth a few times, get your use out of it.
All right, so we have to answer this question, or can we just sit here and make fun of
bad
cars?
I have to answer this question because I've come up with my answer.
Mine was, and I was so proud of mine.
The guy that figured it out beforehand. You
know, the rest of us are on the spot.
When you ask the question, you have months to think about it.
This was my idea.
I made the test and I got 100 on it. I mean, I know all the answers.
Literally,
very good.
He says it on the podcast. I'm not the first to think. Right? Okay. Yeah.
But, and this is part of the point of the thought experiment. What I came up with was a Toyota Century.
Oh,
good
solid,
call!
Right?
Good call!
Solid.
Wait,
yes.
How are you going to buy a Century for $200,000 though?
Oh,
but it had to be.
That?
Yeah, they're way cheaper.
Not brand new.
Oh, you're buying a new Century.
Well, that's the thing.
Salute. Holy.
Hold on. Can I spend some of the money on moving to Japan? Because I'd like to get on that.
So I found one. I think it was actually DuPont. I found one that was about, I think, 210 that might have been 1 or 2 years old.
Yeah.
And
oh, man.
It would I figured 90,000, surely I can get it here for 90,000. I mean, maybe I was wrong, but I was like, if I have 90,000 to get it here, like... Maybe
I mean, if it's only a couple years old, you can't import it. That's the problem, right?
It has to be old.
Well, we don't even know what the maintenance costs were, because you were trying to get us to think about maintenance, too, and it had a V12.
Right,
but it's a Toyota.
But it's a V12. You have a 12 spark plug.
Tell that
to
literally everybody who owns a high mileage Tacoma. I mean,
my Tacoma's got an 8-liter V12 out of a Dodge Viper.
Listen, the only way it can be better is a Honda. Okay,
that's a good question.
And here's I'd love to hear those answers. But the point was, and this is exactly what you're getting at. We're like post car. We've got to this awful place where. And not that it's true everywhere, and there's still some cool stuff out there. And like I said, hopefully we're getting away from the horsepower war.
I think the driver's cars are coming back, not to interject, but look at Nissan and their new Z car.
Yeah,
they're not going for
good.
Killer power. They're going for style and something that speaks to you and feels good.
But that's what the utility of whatever a car can be, if it can't be driven, maybe for some, but I just don't like that. For whatever it is, if it doesn't have utility... I wouldn't hold McLaren to the same standard I would at an Accord. That's not fair as far as that goes, because they're not built. It's not that they couldn't engineer that; they're engineering it to do a different thing.
Yeah.
But the fact that, when you think about 200,000 and you think about like what's available and stuff, it's just the fact that you would absolutely lament the thought of being responsible for repairs and maintenance. I don't know. It was kind of meant as commentary on the state of things that it's. We're abandoning what a car was ever supposed to be in some instances, and just
it's like Jeremy Clarkson still loving the 2005 and 6 Ford GTs,
even though they gave him every reason to hate it.
Totally impractical. He had to pay for gas all the time because it was a gas hog, but he loved those cars since he was a kid when they were GT40s, and when they came out with the final iteration, in my opinion, it just blew him away.
Yeah,
sorry, twin turbo V6s are great and all, but so what are y'all's cars?
Yeah,
that's what we want to know, actually.
I'm ready.
Okay.
He's already ready.
Well, that was part one of our post-car podcast with Michael and Sam, two of our favorite guests. It's also worth noting they're our only guests at this point, but we've loved having them, and we've got two more parts coming up of this, so stay tuned, and if we can get it cranked over, we'll have more for you to listen to.
Hey, Jim, hit her with the sparkulator fluid.